Session number 18614, Reel 5.
Jack Holness, Reel 5.
I was in Mesometru for one night only, and then we were taken to the railhead, the only railhead up the desert at Fort Capuzzo. It turned out that we were to board the last hospital train which got out of the desert at that time. We were put into compartments, walking wounded, sitting in compartments. There were stretcher coaches for the worst wounded. We eventually got off from Capuzzo in this train, and an orderly came round after a few hours and he said, I want the next worst wounded, sort of said, come on to me. He said, you can have a bed, a stretcher bed. And I went into a coach where there were several officers, were all mixed, and very well treated. There were nurses on board, as I remember, and we were given drinks and chocolate, cigarettes, things we weren't used to. And we travelled throughout that day and the whole of the next day, throughout the night, stopping and starting, and stopping because of raids on different places and enemy aircraft activity. It was a bit of a ride. And eventually, after almost 2 days, we arrived at Cairo main station. There were fleets of ambulances, and I had up to that point managed to stay with my section sergeant. He was still unconscious, and this was after probably 4 days, 5 days, I can't quite remember, on our journey down, and he was still unconscious. And we were taken to various ambulances outside the station. There we were separated. I was taken to the 15th Scottish General, which was situated on the banks of the Nile. Later to find out, it was the poshest hospital in the area, had been built by King Farouk as a maternity hospital for his upper class Egyptian women. But of course the military had taken it over. It was known as the 15th Scottish General, and it was a very classy hospital. I was very lucky. Others were taken to various hospitals around the area. I don't know where my sergeant went. The first thing that happened at the hospital, we were taken in hand, taken into a reception area, and individual nurses took us under their wing. I was taken into a bathroom, stripped, put into a bath, and I might say when that was over, because I had quite a growth, even as a young man, I had quite a growth on my face. My hair was matted, it was in a terrible state, hadn't been cut for a long time, and looked like a bit of a gollywog, I think. When they ran the bath water out, there must have been 2 inches of mud left in the bottom of the bath. It was so dirty and full of sand. Anyway, cleaned us up, dressed in clean pajamas, and taken to a mess room for the first meal, real meal I'd had in months. We were given, as I can remember, fried eggs and bacon, sausages, proper bread and best butter. Marvellous. We were then taken to wards, put into bed. And doctors came round to examine us. And the next day, I was taken down into the theatre. No, first of all, x-rayed. And then, as I remember, taken to the theatre where they cut off the plaster that was on my arm. I was put to sleep. When I woke up, my arm was set in a totally different... It had been roughly plastered in Tobruk, but it was set in a totally different position from well above my elbow to almost to my fingertips, and it seemed to be in a very funny position to my way of thinking. I felt pain then from that, but subsided, got used to it. They had treated the neck and back wound, and I felt at peace in the hospital there because it was so clean, such a lovely place. I even managed to get my bed pushed out onto a balcony overlooking the Nile because it was so hot. I slept out there at night. And whilst I was there, I got my first mail from the UK. I tell a lie. It wasn't my first. I'd had one parcel during my time up the desert. But when you got mail in those days, it came in bundles. You didn't get any for 3-4 months, and then you got a bundle. And whilst in the hospital, I got a bundle of about, must have been in the region of 30, 40 pieces of mail. There, on reading I opened one of the first of my fiancé's letters. And what I found out later was it was a second one. She'd written one before that, which I hadn't opened. And she joined the ATS during that time, and she was already ensconced or established in the ATS. The letter came from, if I remember right, from Durham, where she'd gone for some initial training. I never wanted her to go into the service, but she had. She'd done that. She hadn't had much choice. She had choice of going into munitions or the service, so she'd chosen the service. She did the best thing, I now realise. And I stayed there for, quite remember. I wasn't kept in bed, as were some of the other poor fellows, very badly wounded. But it got to a point where I could walk around the wards and see some of the chaps and fetch and carry for them, help as much as I could. And I stayed there for about probably a month. During that time, I was issued with hospital blues, as where soldiers who were hospitalised, you were issued with an awful coloured blue suit. Heavy material, a white shirt and a bright red tie. There was no escaping the fact that you were hospitalised. I was told that I could go out, see the sights, if you like to call it that. Across the Nile was a place called Gezira. It was the posh part of Cairo, and the Gezira Sporting Club was where the upper crust of the Egyptian people would assemble. But of course all these places have been taken over by the military. And as I had round my neck a thick wadding of dressing, cotton wool, must have been about 2 inches thick, the dressing around my neck, I obviously couldn't put a tie on. I had an open-necked white shirt, and it was so hot, but we were supposed to wear this hospital jacket, this bright blue. It was terrible blue, blue of the Union Jack. And we were allowed out. There was a New Zealand sentry on the gate of the hospital, and he checked you as you went out. I got to the gate, and the red tie I've got draped just round my neck loosely. Couldn't possibly tie it. The sentry said, "Why haven't got your tie? Why haven't you got your tie on?" One can well imagine. I didn't answer him, I just looked at him. I gave him a steely look. I had this dressing round my neck. I was carrying the jacket because the temperature was so high. He said, "You're supposed to have your jackets on." We were all carrying jackets. We gave him the inevitable V sign and walked on. We were taken across the Nile, which is very narrow at that point, in the middle of Cairo, and we were put aboard a little boat and ferried across to the sporting club. I can't remember what we did. We know we got into this club and we were given ice cream, of all things. Wonderful. We hadn't tasted ice cream or had soft drinks for a long, long time. We came back from there because we were only allowed out for a few hours. We got back. Eventually, I was visited by a padre at the hospital. Told him certain things. "Anything you want?" I said, "Yes. I'd like a pipe," because I'd smoked a pipe always, even though I was very young. I liked my pipe. And, of course, I'd lost it with all my kit. I came out of the desert with nothing. Was what I stood up in, and all my kit was lost, and the precious pipe was lost. Therefore, I eventually got one from the Nafi. I was able to have a pipe of tobacco again. We had a scare whilst there when the German forces were moving further down, and they got to the then known Alamein line, and the worry was that it would overrun and get through eventually to Alex and Cairo. This, of course, which we later know didn't happen. They held firm. A remnant of my battalion, which I later found out, 100-odd men, joined that defensive line for a few days. That was all that was left of our battalion strength of 850. And they joined that defensive line for a few days before being pulled out themselves. they decided, most of us at the 15th Scottish General should be evacuated from there, which we eventually were, and I was sent to put on a train, and we were sent on our way to Palestine to a place called El Arish, to a convalescent camp on the seafront. It was just a tented and hutted camp. But on the way there, at the station, before crossing over what they call a place called Kantara, where the bridge takes you over the other side, the Arabian side of the Suez Canal, there's a station called Benhur, which they pronounce Benha. You've heard of the film Benhur in days past. This was a station called Benhur. The train stopped. I had my head out of the carriage window, looking down the train. About two coaches along, a head popped out of the window. Turned out to be my old section sergeant, Sergeant Stacey. He saw me, he shouted, he jumped out of the train and along and joined me. Couldn't stop talking. What happened? He'd been unconscious for apparently 7 or 8 days. He'd got to a hospital at a place called Tel Al Kabir. I said, "Quieten down, Jack." His name was Jack, same as me. "Quieten down, Jack, and I'll try to explain to you what happened when we got knocked out and what I've since learned from visits I've had, what happened." He was shaking me and asking me what happened to the rest of the lads in the section, and I gave him what information I could. I asked him when he woke up. He woke up after about 8 days in this hospital, and he said he came out of a cloud, very hazy, and he could see a white headdress leaning over him. And being a West Yorkshireman from Mexborough, he was very broad of tongue, and his words were, "Who are thou?" The voice said, "I'm the sister." His retort was, "You're not my bloody sister." He said, and then I gradually came out of this fog and realization came to him where he was, but he could not remember a thing that had happened to him or any of us. He could not remember anything after the morning of the evacuation and what was happening. He remembered nothing from there. He could remember just sitting in this dugout with me. Beyond that, nothing. So I had the job of explaining that this time the news had filtered through to me what had happened to the battalion. Either killed or wounded or prisoners of war, the majority. There were 108 who made it under their own steam, had been scattered, and 108 made it through with a major who would then had to take command of the remains of the battalion. Was my company commander, Major Saint Hill. He got the DSO for bringing out so many guns and these remnants of the battalion, and I explained all this to Jack Stacey. And I'd heard by this time that my section, two had been killed, The rest were prisoners of war. We too were wounded, and we were lucky we'd got out. I considered myself very, very lucky. We went to Ellerich Convalescent Camp, and we stayed there about 2 weeks. During that time, we were allowed to walk into the med, into the water. It was wonderful, walking wounded, going down. They were taking people down in chairs and escorting them into the water. And I could walk in up, well up my body and holding my arm up above. And I remember meeting a medical orderly there. It came to me, because the thing that used to happen with anybody in plaster was where you were plastered, they would put their particular stamp or blue pencil on your plaster. And it was a usual thing for people to autograph, put little remarks all the way down your plaster, even if you had it on your chest or arms or wherever. And this medical orderly came to me and said, "I recognise that plaster." He said, "I was there when they put it on in the theatre. I was a theatre orderly." "Oh yeah," he said. "Do you know what they did with your arm?" I said, "No, I was totally out. I was asleep." He said, "Oh well, did you?" I said, "What did they do?" I said, "I know this from when I first went in there. It came out in a..." Because they'd just done in Tobruk on a straight job, and when I came out, it was round here. And he said, "Well, they just..." He said, "They just picked your arm up and put it over a wooden V-shaped block and went like that with it."
Banged it down with it.
He said, "And then they set about resetting it."
They broke it again.
They broke it again. They broke it again because it had started partly knit in the way it had been done, which then the x-rays showed up totally wrong. So it was... I broke both main bones, you see. Both main bones were broken. And not realising until much later, the 13th of June 42, when that happened, turned out to be my lucky day. Because before I left the hospital, they downgraded me to what they call a B grading, B1, unfit for frontline action, excused all weapons. I was sent back to the 15th Scottish from Palestine for another period of few weeks. I then went to another convalescent camp just along the Suez, not so far away, I think for a fortnight. By this time, they'd established the defensive line and held off Rommel and his troops, and things were getting back to normal in the Cairo and Alexander Egyptian area. I was discharged from the convalescent camp eventually back to the guards' base depot on the Suez Road, a place called Geneva, and still with a big plaster on my arm. And I was to attend on a weekly basis the nearest hospital to the camps there. That was... The whole of the Suez Road, Geneva, was just full of tented camps, mainly the infantry out there. It was the place I'd first arrived at from UK. I reported in and was told that I would get some kind of job whilst in the camp. What was I fitted for? Oh, ideal for a regimental policeman. The plaster on your arm, you'll be able to knock a few bods, plaster on them. So I got a job as a regimental policeman for a while. And then was asked if I would rather like to stop that and go into the officer's mess as a mess waiter. I thought, well, nothing ventured, nothing gained. I'm learning something else all the time. So I went into the officer's mess, which, like everywhere else, was a tented affair. And I started to wait on tables in the officer's mess and also learning bar work. We were very, very busy in the morning and at night, breakfast, dinners. And it was a concrete surface, tented concrete surface, but it was furnished with the odd settee, chairs, comfortable at those standards. And we lived, the staff, there were four of us, waiters, the mess sergeant, lived in tents just outside. We had some Italian artisan prisoners of war as labourers at that time. They were very nice people, they were very nice chaps. They weren't military, they were artisans who had been picked up in the early part of the Desert War. And I stayed in that job for some time. And then I was asked after that, if I would like to go into the quartermaster's stores as the quartermaster's clerk, which I said, yes, I would do that. And partly working in the orderly room, I started to learn all about the quartermaster's side of things, equipment, pay, etc. Whilst doing that job, the quartermaster was repatriated to the UK. I was left doing the job, issuing equipment, pay duties, whilst as a guardsman. We had a Scots Guards Sergeant Major, the Guards Company there. We had a Coldstream Major, Major Watts Russell. He had been up at the battalion, but he'd been sent down again and was commanding the unit at that time. I was doing this quartermaster's job, which quartermaster in any guards battalion is Seeker Mess. He has three stripes and a crown. I was given to understand they were going to promote a sergeant to quartermaster after the previous one had been repatriated. I, at that time, was doing most of the work. One-armed, may I add. And the sergeant came in doing the job. He said, do you know anything about this? I said, I'm doing it. I've learned what there is to learn and I'm doing it. He said, well, you'll have to show me. This was a sergeant. I had a few words with the sergeant major as regards this position.